Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Reminder to sign up for our weekly email through Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all the links to the articles and books that I've discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our friends and sponsors, Jen and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. There's an old joke about Daf Yomi, Ba Shabbos, Ba Menucha. When Shabbos comes, rest comes. There's always a lot of enthusiasm for the opening tractate, the opening Maseches Brachos, but once the larger, denser, more technical Shabbos rolls around, Daf Yomi study tends to drop off. It's time to rest, and that's when everybody kind of lays Daf Yomi off by the side. I think there's a similar struggle with Shnayim Mikra, the weekly study of the Parsha. There's always enthusiasm in the beginning, creation, the stories of our Avos and Imam, hosts, the patriarchs and matriarchs, redemption from Egypt, the giving of the Torah, the establishment of the Mishkan, and then Sefer Vayikra comes around, which primarily deals with sacrificial offerings, and all of a sudden, studying the Parsha isn't so easy. Is now time to rest? Our Parsha, in fact, opens up with added motivation, as if we're about to slowly close our Chumash and take that much-needed rest. Our Parsha opens up, Tzav es Aaron v'ezbanav lemor, command Aaron and his children with the following. Moshe is told to command Aaron and his family of Kohanim the laws related to a Karban Ola, the sacrificial offering that was entirely burnt on the altar. Rashi explains the need for the added term Tzav to command Aaron and his family about this sacrifice. Rashi says, Ein Tzav ela lashon zeruz, miyad uladoros. The word Tzav, Rashi explains, is meant to urge and motivate this commandment for Aaron, his family, and all future generations. Rashi also adds a comment from Rabbi Shimon that this added urgency was necessary because of the monetary cost that sacrifices, that karbanos, actually cost. Amar Rabbi Shimon, Biyoser tzarach hakasav lazares, we needed an added motivation for this pasuk, b'makom sheyesh chisaron kis, in a place where it costs money. It costs a lot of money to bring karbanos, and that's why we have this added motivation, so to speak, because of the cost. It's strange, however, that this urgency is meant for Aaron and all future generations. Why do all future generations need this motivation if for much of Jewish history, since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, we no longer bring sacrifices? How is our generation meant to interpret this motivation? Is it some much-needed chizuk, encouragement, to continue learning Shnayim Mikra? Why include such urgency for all future generations regarding a commandment that future generations won't even be able to fulfill? And secondly, the financial concerns, a strange thing to share with Aaron and his family. They were not the ones buying the karbanos. They weren't spending a penny on the karbanos. It didn't cost Kohanim anything. It costed whomever brought the sacrifice. So why is this reason being shared now with Aaron and his fellow Kohanim? To understand this, let's explore some of the controversies surrounding the most popular chumash of the last generation, the Hertz Chumash. I grew up across the street from a shul known as Shaarei Tefila in Lawrence, New York. Quite a bit has changed in the shul since my childhood years. The box of doilies for women to don when they entered either disappeared or was moved to a much more discreet location. I'm not sure my current students even know what a doily is. That's the honest truth. Spare talesim and yarmulkes are no longer in a place right next to the sidurim and chumashim. And the very chumash I remember as a kid has changed. Back in the day, I was probably 7 or 8 years old. The primary chumash on the shelves was the Hertz chumash. I don't think that was its official name, but it was colloquially referred to as the Hertz chumash, named after Rabbi Dr. Joseph H. Hertz, who was born in 1872, served as the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom from 1913 until his passing in 1946. It was an imposing tome that, and I still remember this, used Roman numerals instead of standard numbers. I don't think my 7-year-old self was its target audience. By the time my Bubby, Edith Beshefkin, passed away in 1994, there was already a new chumash in town that was quickly filling up shelves, the Art Scroll Stone Chumash. I remember my father dedicated a few of the new Art Scroll Chumashim that had just been published the year prior in 1993, and I had assumed the advent of a new, more modernly designed chumash is what led to the downfall of the Hertz Chumash, which of course is at least in part true. Upon closer look, however, the story behind Rabbi Hertz, his legacy, and the disappearance appearance of many of his works is a more controversial and nuanced story. Thankfully, a few of my friends are like Shul detectives. They've written prolifically about the liturgical changes, the evolution of the Siddur, as well as the different classical chumashim found in synagogues. And of course, they have explored, in depth, the story of Rabbi Hertz and his works. Rabbi Joseph H. Hertz was a part of the first graduating class of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Nowadays, the seminary is considered the flagship school of the conservative movement, but its denominational affiliation back then was considerably more ambiguous. After serving in congregations in America, he was elected as Britain's chief rabbi in 1913 as an Orthodox rabbi, of course. He was just over 40 years old. As Meir Persov details in his eye-opening book, this book is a lot of fun, it's called Hats in the Ring, Choosing Britain's Chief Rabbis from Adler to Sack. Just a side note, I love the stories behind prabbas. Whenever I visit a community, I love asking or finding out who are the other rabbis who applied for this job. A prabba is the event where rabbis visit a shul for 1 week, act as rabbi. It's like their tryout in this, you know, American Idol rabbinic contest. And I love finding out who else was there. And this is a whole book about how they chose the chief rabbis of Britain, who else applied. And becoming a chief rabbi of England is always a tricky position. It's not quite as laissez-faire as the American rabbinate, and is far more centralized than other European countries. There's always a vocal minority who assumes the chief rabbi is not Orthodox enough. This was certainly true of Hertz's tenure. We'll get to that in a second. And there's another vocal minority who assumes the chief rabbi is too Orthodox. For Rabbi Hertz, he had a very vocal minority who thought that he was not Orthodox enough. He was able to garner some support from the more traditional Orthodox community after he appointed the revered Rav Chatzkel Abramsky, author of the Chazon Yecheskel, on Tosefta, which is its own fascinating story. He smuggled it out, written on toilet paper, I believe. And Rabbi Hertz appointed Rav Chatzkel Abramsky to the London Besdin. So they said, okay, we can work with you a little bit. There was a desperate need for a new English translation of the Chumash. In 1901, Rabbi Solomon Schechter published such a powerful article in the Jewish Chronicle lamenting the state of Jewish knowledge. I know we don't often hear from Rabbi Solomon Schechter himself, but this article that he wrote is so foundational and speaks to, I think, the insecurity that even current generations deal with about how to ensure that Torah remains a vibrant commitment in our lives for each and every generation. This is what Rabbi Solomon Schechter wrote in 1901. But if there was ever a time when a revival of Hebrew learning meant the very existence of Judaism, it is this. It must be clear to everybody, I think, who does not allow himself to be deceived by the few political distinctions which have fallen to our share within the last 50 years, that the new century does not open under very favorable auspices for Judaism. That was certainly true, and he couldn't even realize how true it sadly would become in just a few decades. Everything seems to be out of gear. Our scriptures are the constant object of attack. Our history is questioned and its morality is declared to be of an inferior sort. Our brethren are either directly persecuted or allowed to exist only on sufferance everywhere, with the exception of England and Italy. Worst of all, Rabbi Solomon Schechter writes, is the attitude of the younger generation, who, if not directly hostile, are by dint of their mere ignorance, sadly indifferent to everything Jewish, and thus incapable of taking the place of their parents in the synagogue. Notwithstanding our self-congratulating speeches at the annual distributions of religious prizes, it is a fact that ignorance is on the increase among our better situated classes. Very few are capable of reading their prayers, and less are able to understand what they read. Whilst the number of those who know anything of Israel's past and share in its hope for Israel's future form almost a negligible quantity. Those who have some dim recollection of the religious exercise practiced in the houses of their fathers still entertain some warm regard for Jewish life and Jewish ways of thinking. But religious warmth, like heat in general, is apt to evaporate with the increasing distance of the conductors. And the children or the grandchildren of these sympathetic lookers on are bound to end in that cold, critical radical attitude toward Judaism, terminating in the drifting away from it altogether. I think that is one of the most brilliant sentences I've ever read. I'd like to actually read it again. This is, again, Solomon Schechter describing his concern for the younger generation. But religious warmth, like heat in general, is apt to evaporate with the increasing distance of the conductors, and the children or the grandchildren of these sympathetic lookers-on are bound to end in that cold, critical attitude toward Judaism, terminating in the drifting away from it altogether. The outlook is thus dark enough indeed to be followed by some great revival or renaissance, or as the rabbis put it, the redemption of Israel is preceded like the dawn by intense darkness, as it says, "When I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be light unto me," quoting from Tehillim. Now, the renaissance is usually described as the moment in history in which man discovered himself. In a similar way, the Jew will also have to rediscover himself. It is in this spirit that a Jewish commentary should be written to the whole of the Bible for the great majority of the Jewish public, with whom scripture should again become an object both of study and of edification. This should be the next task to which our clergy should devote themselves in the near future. That is Solomon Schechter raising the alarm and saying we need to do something to keep the next generation involved in Yiddishkeit. And that thing is, we need to make the Torah accessible in translation. This is almost 100 years before Art Scroll, before Koren, before Steinsaltz. Solomon Schechter saying this is what is necessary to keep people engaged in Yiddishkeit. Rabbi Solomon Schechter's concern left a deep impression on Rabbi Hertz. The latter decided to take it upon himself to translate Torah and liturgy in order to make it more accessible for a younger generation. The Hertz Chumash was indeed different. Firstly, it included both the translation and the original Hebrew text side by side, an obvious improvement to previous translations that never included the original Hebrew. You'd have to lug two separate volumes together to shul. Rabbi Hertz also responded to the growing field of biblical criticism. His commentary features direct responses to the theories of Wellhausen, reasoned defenses of the morality of the Torah, and appeals to the historicity of the Torah based upon archaeological findings. To the modern audience, it may seem strange to spend so much time within a Chumash defending its authenticity, but Hertz once again was inspired by Rabbi Solomon Schechter's call, which Schechter made in a famous 1903 speech entitled "Higher Criticism, Higher Antisemitism," to respond to challenges to the Torah's authenticity. Like all ambitious projects, the Hertz Chumash was not without its detractors. Many other scholars collaborated on the project, and after the first volume of the Hertz Chumash was published, several of those contributors wrote a letter to Rabbi Hertz expressing their frustration at the lack of credit they were given. Why was only Rabbi Hertz's name, they wondered, the only one on the cover? If only they knew the Chumash itself would be referred to as the Hertz Chumash throughout history, they would not have been happy. As someone who himself, me, David, hi, presses Control F, this is an embarrassing little secret, but my close friends know it's true, I press Control F and then type in my own name to find my name in articles and books I've contributed to see if I got any credit. I'll be honest, I'm pretty sympathetic to the concerns of Hertz's collaborators. Rabbi Hertz, however, responded to his fellow collaborators and explains it was not common practice to list anyone on the cover other than the editor. "Nothing is further from my nature," he wrote, "than to deprive others of the honor which is justly their due." The criticism leveled at Rabbi Hertz was not limited to his collaborators. Sales for the first volume, Beratius, was printed standalone, were slow, and Rabbi Hertz assumed that it was because of a lack of interest. He even considered abandoning the project altogether. Consumers, however, were just waiting for the full project to be completed before purchasing, a sentiment I have personally expressed when I have come across a not yet fully completed publication. I hate just buying the first volume. I need to buy the full set. The most serious criticism of Rabbi Hertz and his works came from elsewhere, as my dear friend Shaul Seidlerfeller documents in his fascinating but unpublished article, "The Rebbe, the Chief Rabbi, and the Scandal of Scholarly Indifference on a Forgotten Hasidic Master's Critique of the Hertz Prayer Book." It's a fascinating article. Rabbi Hertz also printed a siddur with the same purpose as his Chumash, to make traditional Hebrew texts more accessible for the current generation. As Rabbi Hertz himself explained, it would be well for the Jewish religion if the beauty and devotional power so largely manifested in its prayers were more intelligently appreciated by its adherents today. He said, quoting a well-known theologian not so long ago, "The purpose of this work," Hertz continued, "is to render possible such an intelligent appreciation on the part of the ordinary worshiper. And it is the fervent prayer of the author that with the help of God, his labors lead to a deepening of devotion in the tents and sanctuaries of Israel in English-speaking lands." One major Hasidic leader, Rev Yerucham Liner, however, took major issue with Rabbi Hertz's work, specifically Rabbi Hertz's approach to sacrifices. Rev Yerucham Liner was a nephew of Rev Gershon Henoch Liner, the grandson of the Rebbe of Ishbitz. Ishbitz began with Rev Mordechai Yosef Liner. His son Yaakov Liner moved Ishbitz to Radzin, and his grandson, Rev Gershon Henoch Liner, was famous in his own right for his Hasidic teachings, and he was the one who tried to rediscover the Tcheles dye for tzitzis. Rev Gershon Henoch's nephew was Rev Yerucham Liner, who was a major scholar in his own right, the author of Teferis Yerucham, and a scion to one of the most fascinating and exciting Hasidic schools of thought known as Ishbitz Radzin. Full disclosure, my master's thesis in Jewish studies focuses on Rev Tzadok, who was a student of the original Rebbe of Ishbitz, Rev Mordechai Yosef Liner. I have a whole chapter in my book Synagogue about the history of the movement and why it is so controversial. But if I start plugging my books in here now, we're never going to get to history or the Parsha. Most of Rev Yerucham Liner's critiques of Rabbi Hertz are fairly technical. One critique, however, is searing, suggesting that Rabbi Hertz's commentary may have veered into heretical territory. Rabbi Hertz wrote as follows regarding the sacrifices. This is what he has in his siddur, and he's really quoting from an earlier siddur before the Musaf prayer. "This portion of the Musaf prayer has been much assailed in modern times. References to the sacrificial service and especially prayers for its restoration are disliked by some," wrote the principal of Jews College, the saintly Dr. Friedlander, over 50 years ago. "In view of the late origin of this prayer, and in view furthermore that for a long time, the whole Musaf prayer was deemed to be voluntary for the individual worshiper, we can quite endorse his decision to do as follows. Let him whose heart is not with the fellow worshippers," this was written in the siddur, "let him whose heart is not with his fellow worshippers in any of their supplications silently substitute his own prayers for them. But let him not interfere with the devotion of those to whom the statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart, the commandments of the Lord pure, enlightening the eyes, the judgments of the Lord true and righteous altogether," quoting from Tehillim, "and who continue to yearn for the opportunity of fulfilling divine commandments which they cannot observe at present." Essentially, Rabbi Hertz allows those who are uncomfortable with the notion of the return of sacrifices in the literal sense to silently reflect on something else, so long as they do not disrupt those who do still maintain this standard belief. This concession was too much for Rev Yerucham Liner. "This opinion was put forward by the founders of Reform Judaism," Rabbi Liner writes, "Holtheim and Geiger, but it is hardly in accord with Orthodox traditions of Judaism. Undoubtedly, it seemed too accommodating to the recent reforms of Abraham Geiger and Radical Reform that advocating removing mention of the return of sacrifices altogether from the liturgy." That was their position. At the time, think about it, the 1885 Pittsburgh Platform, this is around the time, just almost two decades later, the Pittsburgh Platform of the Reform Movement that stated, "We consider ourselves no longer a nation." This is the 1885 Pittsburgh Platform of the Reform Movement, the first half of which we spoke about in our shiur for Parshas Lech Lecha. Let's focus on the second half. This is what it wrote. "We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine," that's what we spoke about, "nor a sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state." This was still fresh in everyone's mind. So was Rabbi Hertz a secret reformer? In truth, Rabbi Hertz was not alone in trying to figure out how the notions of sacrifices could be made more palatable to the modern mind. Many other rabbis at the turn of the 20th century were grappling with the same issue. As Mark Shapiro points out in his always fascinating post on the Sfarim blog, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, known as the Sridei Eish after his responsa, responded to a similar suggestion made by another from Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchak Sheinfeld of Milwaukee, who suggested references to the return of sacrifices should be altered. Rav Weinberg responded, "Ein dunin kan al etzem harayon hayisodi shel hakarbanos. Lu haisa hayom kayamas etzlenu she'ela kazos, v'hi doreshes pitaron dachuf. Ein mispar mitzumsam shel Yehudim be'eretz achaz b'nei samchus lahachriya b'inyin zeh, v'kol shekein kasher heim einam miyatzkim es klal Yisrael." We cannot, Rav Weinberg explains, just just omit or alter our text without a rabbinic body that really represents the will of the collective Jewish people. In the absence of such an authoritative body, no text should be altered. What he doesn't do is dismiss the very possibility. He says, maybe we can, maybe we can't, but you need an authoritative body like a Sanhedrin in Eretz Yisrael. We don't have that right now. We don't have that anymore. So we got to keep the text as they are. The most famous alternative approach to sacrifices, undoubtedly, is that of Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who suggested in his commentary on the Siddur, Olat Raya, that in the future, sacrifices may be brought from vegetation, from vegetables, rather than animals. Much has been written in reaction to Rav Cook's radical suggestion, but it's hard to deny that he was reacting to the very same modern sensibilities that Rav Hertz considered when including his note in his commentary. Rather than a concession to reform, both rabbis were trying to expand the resonance of Torah for a new generation. Neither were saying that sacrifices definitively will be or should be discarded, but they were creating a space for those struggling with that notion to continue their traditional communal affiliation. And that, in many ways, speaks to Rav Hertz's life and legacy. New doorways into traditional Jewish life and thought need to be built for each and every generation. As Shaul Seidler-Feller writes, what this brief, virtually neglected episode in the annals of Anglo-Jewish and American Jewish history does represent, if nothing else, is yet another manifestation of the highly divisive nature of relations between and within mid-20th century Jewish denominations in the course of their great struggle for the soul of modern Jewry. And that's what they were fighting for, the soul of what would come next, what would be born, so to speak, on American Jewish soil. There are many who still miss the style and approach of Rabbi Hertz. As Professor David Berger lamented, I still regret the eclipse of the Hertz Chumash, which, for all its drawbacks, introduced a generation of Jews to a humane and uplifting vision of Judaism. But the legacy of the Hertz Chumash still continues, each generation building new doorways or resonance and relevance for the next generation to enter. And that brings us back to our Parsha. Ein Tzav Ela Lashon Zeruz. Why of all mitzvahs are the sacrifices introduced with an added urgency for all generations, especially considering that future generations won't even be bringing sacrifices? The Chassam Sofer explains that the added urgency is not for the actual offering of sacrifices, since during the entire time when we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, such sacrifices won't even be brought. Instead, the urgency is directed at the Torah study about the ideas of karbanos, of the sacrificial offerings. As the Talmud in Menachos on page 110 on Kuf Yud Amud Aleph explains, whoever studies Torah related to the sacrifices, it is as if they brought a sacrifice themselves. There will be a time where sacrifices are no longer brought, which is why it is so crucial to continue their study, finding meaning and relevance even in practices we no longer fully understand or appreciate. And this is why Aaron is warned about sharing a mitzvah that even includes a loss of money. The mitzvah is not referring to the actual bringing of karbanos, since Kohanim didn't lose any money from the sacrifices other people brought. Instead, it is urging Aaron to share this Torah idea that the Jewish people can remain connected to the notion of sacrifices, even conceptually through their Torah study. And even though that may reduce the amount of actual karbanos brought, because people say, hey, instead of bringing a karban, I'm just going to learn about karbanos. And that would cause a financial loss to the Kohanim, because they normally get to eat them. So it's crucial to remind the Jewish people that they can nonetheless still do this. Don't not teach them this Torah so you could eat more karbanos. Hashem is urging Aaron, teach this Torah to the Jewish people. They can always remain connected to karbanos, even if they're not actually bringing them through the Torah study of the ideas of karbanos. As distant as such practices may seem to many modern ears, through our conceptual study of Torah and through our unceasing prayers, our collective connection to karbanos still continues today. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. It's a weekly email. It's not scary. Just go to that website, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Sign up. You get all these great links to all these books, articles that you can't find anywhere else. Thank you once again to our friends and sponsors, Jen and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. I am so grateful for your friendship and support. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.